Hi, thank you so much for having me. Name is Deb Schneider, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, my sobriety date is December the 8th of 2020. I have a home group, I have a sponsor, and I have not yet had the opportunity to sponsor other women, but I'm qualified to do that, and I'm looking forward to the time when I get to do that as life evolves. As it instructs us in the big book, I aim to share my experience, strength, and hope with you fine and lovely people this evening. I will try to describe what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. By way of background, I was born in Chapel Hill, wasn't born there, but moved there and was raised in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I was born in 1960, which for my growing up years, it was a very permissive time, in the 70s, very permissive culture in the small university town of Chapel Hill. And there was alcohol everywhere, everywhere. There was also a lot of alcohol in my family. I think it is a fair statement that I come from a family of alcoholics. We never said that word. We were not allowed to say that word. But now that I've been in the program and understand my own alcoholism, I feel that from my experience, both of my parents drank alcoholically. And that wasn't the reason that I became one, but that was the culture in which I grew up. I was raised in a family of four, my two parents, mother and father, and my older brother, Mick. He is a year and a half older than I, and we have always been very, very close emotionally, very close. This will become more clear as I share my story about my image of us. You might have seen the like bookends or a picture or a sculpture of two frightened monkeys that are kind of holding onto each other, like, like this. That's the way my brother and I were at in our growing up years. Our father was a very remote individual. He was completely opaque to me in any kind of emotional way. He was a chemical engineer, very highly educated, very highly intelligent, very cerebral. He lived with in our house with me the whole time I was growing up. But my feeling was, my experience was that he hardly said 10 words to me my whole life. He was so austere and withholding, and I was just a puppy dog scampering after him, wanting the tiniest little touch or attention. And I remember one time when I was about eight, he was going off to work. I was sitting at the counter, the kitchen area, having a bowl of cereal, and he was going out the door to work. And I said, "Daddy, Daddy, wait! I want to give you a kiss." So he kind of, harrumphed and bent down, and I kissed him on the cheek. And then he stood up, and he just wiped off the kiss, the milk that I had left on his face or whatever. And that was just a moment. It was just a moment. But for me, it represented so much of my yearning, my feeling of being invisible and unimportant, my feeling that I was a pest and a burden. And those feelings really stuck with me. My mother was a very complicated woman. She had been a beauty in her day. Her appearance, her way of interacting with men was a very important part of her identity. And she taught me what she herself had been taught, which was that a woman's worth is in her body, and that a woman's power is derived from her sexual allure. And that's what I learned. I'm not the only woman in the world to learn that. I mean, there have been messages out in the world for many young girls to absorb. My mom was, she fancied herself to be a vivacious party girl, and she was that. But she was also, from my experience, morose and needy and grasping and mercurial. Her moods would go, they'd be high one minute, and the next a thundercloud would be in the house. And in my relationship with my mother, my job was to appease her, was to reflect her, to build her up, to affirm her, to support her, to meet her emotional needs. And I did a good job. I did a really good job at that. So the combination of the distorted, sort of upside down relationship I had with my mother in terms of who was the caregiver and who was the recipient of care and nurture, combined with my father's emotional impenetrability, set up in me a deep yearning for connection. I was a connection-seeking machine. Any person I could bond to, I wanted to bond. I wanted to meet their needs. I wanted to be who they wanted me to be. And it would be years, years before I was able to put words around that. My mother was a very heavy drinker. Very heavy drinker. She, a couple of images from my childhood kind of paint the picture. Whereas in our neighborhood, we lived in a suburban neighborhood, middle class suburban neighborhood. And at all of my friends' houses, there were kitchen tables with chairs around the kitchen table. And maybe in the middle of the kitchen table, there might be a basket of fruit or some flowers or a package of napkins or something. At our house, we did not have a kitchen table. We had a bar. And the house where we lived had a kind of an elevated island that was bar height. We had bar stools, four of them. And that's fine. That's a fine way to design a kitchen. But the symbolism of it was so profound for me as I aged, as I came into my own alcoholism I began to realize more and more of this. The centerpiece of our kitchen table bar was a handle of Canadian Club whiskey. It was there all the time. Why? Because it was always in use. And my parents were daily drinkers. My mother's drinking got to the point where she drank to passing out every night, and she would pass out on the, she would sit in a bar stool, drink, 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 pass out with her head on the counter. And my father, who I think was as emotionally withholding with my mother as he was with my brother and me, he would turn off all the lights in the house and just go on up to bed. So my brother and I, mostly me is what I remember, but maybe he would remember differently. We had to get her up to bed. So we did that very dutifully. My drinking started at about age 15. I drank everything I could. Every time I could have access, I did. Here again, the time of the in the 70s, very, very permissive time. I read some time ago that the 70s might have been the height of underage drinking in our country. I don't know that to be true, but it seemed to fit what my experience was. I was very quickly a blackout drinker. The way that the lessons that my mother taught me about how to interact with men in particular led me to put myself in very dangerous situations. I disrespected myself, my body, my spirit. I didn't even know I had a spirit back then. And alcohol played a big role in that. So I went to college right in my hometown, drank, 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 and also was very susceptible to other people influencing me and inviting me to do this or that substance. Sure, anything you offer me, I'll do it. No problem. And I was so unmoored, such a cork bobbing on whitewater rapids, I now see. So that continued, that unabated drinking continued through, well, I graduated from college. I went to graduate school in Atlanta, and for all of my parents' shortcomings, they did pay for my education, and I am very, very grateful for that. They worked hard for that money, and I was the beneficiary of their generosity in that way, and I'm very grateful for that. But while I was there in graduate school, I drank like crazy, drank and drank and drank every chance I got to excess, to blackout most of the time. I graduated and began my professional life, and about 3 years into my professional life, I was 29 years old, and my brother called me and told me that I had read in the newspaper that morning that there had been a big plane crash out in Sioux City, Iowa, and my brother called moments after I'd put that newspaper down, and he said, "Our parents were on that plane." And my brother was calling around to all the hospitals in Sioux City trying to discover whether our parents were among the survivors. And they were not. And so my brother and I lost both of our parents when I was 29 and he was 30 or 31. And the significance of that for my sobriety story is that my relationship with my parents stopped at that point in life. I mean, I couldn't. I mean, they might have grown and changed. Surely they would have had they been able to live beyond their ages of death at 54 and 57 years old. But I didn't get to see that. And so, in my mind and heart, they were exactly who they were from the time I was born until their deaths. So our relationship was truncated in that way. Searing loss. And I was, it was a very difficult time. I drank all the way through it. I went after that, I got into therapy and benefited greatly from psychotherapy. I got a lot of insight into my childhood and my yearning and my feeling of never belonging. But in all that time of therapy, I never thought that alcohol was a valid subject for discussion in the therapist's office. She never brought it up. I never brought it up. Well, 6 months after my parents died, I met the man who would become my husband, and he is still my husband to this day. And he is sitting right here in this front row. And I discovered a whole new way of loving. He, on one of our first dates, he was at the restaurant. I was a few minutes late. I came in, he was already seated. I said, "I hope I didn't keep you waiting too long." And he said, "Not too long, just 31 years." He listened to me. He was, whereas I had thought I had behaved all my adult life that men were unfeeling, self-interested predators. This man was not that. He had feelings, he had capacity to converse, and he loved me. I mean, it was just amazing. I couldn't, it took a while to even trust that. But anyway, we got married and we had two children, two boys. They are now ages 32 and 30. We're both thriving in life and doing very well. For purposes of my sobriety story, I drank through all of this time. I'm drinking as I always did, every chance, and always to excess. There was one time when my husband and I were out to an early date, and I ordered a second glass of wine. And he said, "I notice you always order more than one." And I got pretty defensive. And I said, "Well, I don't know if that's a problem." But it was just something that got into my mind and it stayed with me. Well, we had two children, and in those early years of being a mother, a couple of things happened that really caught my attention. One was there's a picture of me that my husband took where it's in the middle of summer. Our older son was about a year old, and I'm in a kiddie pool. You know, there's one of those plastic things you can get at Walmart that it's a kiddie pool. So I'm sitting in the kiddie pool in this picture. I'm sitting in the kiddie pool with our son on my lap, my little toddler on my lap, and I'm holding up a beer and I'm smiling like, yeah, isn't this great? Well, in later years, when I saw that picture, I thought, what is that saying about my priority as a mother? I'm holding up the beer, and below that in the picture is our son. And my mother's drinking was that way. She valued and privileged her drinking over caring for me and my brother and my father. Do I want to be that person? Well, that reflection lasted about 5 minutes, and then I was, drinking again. Another memory that I have of that time, that era of our time in our early time of par as parents, I made a friend in the town who also had two little boys, same ages as our little boys, and we would get together for play dates. We would keep each other's children if we had a doctor's appointment, whatever. We were very close friends, and the four boys were very close friends. And this friend, whose name is Dion, we're still friends today. She and I got into a habit of telephoning each other at around 5 o'clock every day when the play dates were over. She was at her house with her boys. I was at my house with my boys. We would get on the phone and talk about how what a crazy day we had. You wouldn't believe the antics that so and so got into. Oh, I really need a glass of wine right now because you wouldn't believe the day I had. And we would drink wine together in that way and crow about, oh, this has been such an exasperating day. I'll need a whole bottle today. Ha ha. Well, a couple of weeks into that, I got angry about something. I don't even know what, but I was huffing and puffing and slamming kitchen drawers and, clearly being exasperated. And our son said to me, "Mommy, do you need some wine?" And he was three. So that really hit me between the eyes. And at about that time, because of this truth that was chasing me, that my drinking was out of control, it was taking more of a place in my life than I wanted. And for some reasons related to some other things unrelated to me and my drinking, my husband and I decided we're going to stop drinking. It's not good for us. We are on a health kick. We're going to stop drinking. And we were in solidarity about that. So we packed up wine glasses, martini shakers, corkscrews, jiggers, every accoutrement known to man that we had accumulated related to alcohol, packed it all up, put it in the attic. And I think we gave away all our alcohol too, but I don't really remember that part. So we were abstinent for 4 years. But I didn't have a program. I didn't enlarge my spiritual life. And my program of sobriety, if you could call it that, during those 4 years was rigidity, white knuckles, and an attitude of superiority. I'm not drinking. I'm better than you. I'm better than you. Well, you can imagine what happened very soon into this experiment. Just like the big book says, a brief period of relapse followed by more and more drinking. And that is exactly what occurred. And just as it was described in the big book, you might remember the story of the, I think he was a traveling salesman and he had been sober. He went to on a sales trip and he went into the bar just to get a sandwich. And he got a glass of milk with his sandwich and he thought, just thought popped into his mind, maybe a glass of a shot of whiskey would taste good in my milk. So he got that. And it went on from there. Well, a very similar thing happened to me, similar in contour as it regards drinking. So we had been abstinent for all this period of time. We had some friends in the town we were living in who the fella got a job promotion, so they were moving to Atlanta. And they came by to say goodbye. They brought their boys with them, our boys and our two and their three were great friends and they palled around together. So I said, well, we got to celebrate your new adventure in Atlanta. I happen to have some cooking wine. Let's have a glass of cooking wine and make a toast to your new home in Atlanta. Cooking wine. This is on the aisle, the vinegar aisle in the grocery store next to the pickles. But we drank it, and from there, off to the races for me. And I was thinking all along these years, am I an alcoholic? I don't know. I don't think I am. And I would take tests on in the women's magazine. Are you drinking too much? And I always had a reason why I was not an alcoholic. Always. Then a friend of mine invited me to an AA meeting. This was in 2008. I didn't get sober until 2020. Went to my first AA meeting in 2008. And it made an impression on me. The fellowship, the community, her remarks about her sponsor and the close relationship that she had with her sponsor made a deep impression on me. And so when I got home from that meeting, I said, honey, guess what? I'm stopping. So I took all the bottles of wine. There were probably 12 in the house at the time. And I put them in a laundry basket and I took them out to the trash can and I put them in the trash can. I didn't dump them in the trash can. And at 5 o'clock that evening, I went back out with the empty laundry basket and filled it back up with those wine bottles and drank every drop, as in time would, didn't drink all 12 bottles in one night, but and I just kept knowing deep down that my drinking was a problem, but I didn't want to see it. And but I was able to speak out loud about cutting back. That was my strategy. And we know this from the big book. all the ways that we tried. So my husband is very handy. He can fix anything, he can make anything. He's a woodworker, he's a metalsmith, he's a leather worker. And we had the idea together that he would make tokens, 10 tokens. He cut out little coins of leather, put a stamp on each one, 1 through 10. And I was going to limit myself to 10 drinks a week. 10 drinks a week. So I tried that for a little while, about a week or so. And I came back to my husband and I said, "Honey, I need more tokens." So, different ways of trying and failing to get it under control. So, I got into the habit. I was drinking every day, pretty much all of my adult life, except for that period of abstinence I was telling you about, and except for my pregnancies. But it got to the point where I was drinking enough every night to go to sleep on the couch at around 8 p.m. Now I use the term pass out because that's what it was, but I was very sensitive about that phrase at the time. And my husband said, "You know, I get lonely in the evenings when you go to sleep on the couch at 8 p.m. And I said to myself, "Yeah, too bad. I'm drinking. It's what I want to do." And the pandemic happened around that time. And of course, being housebound, I shouldn't say of course, because this isn't true for everybody, but for me, being housebound accelerated my drinking. I just drank more because I didn't have anywhere, didn't have to go anywhere. But during that time, a couple of things happened to get me to my bottom. One thing was our younger son, who at that time was in his 20s, he had had a really circuitous path. He was having trouble getting traction in his young adult life. We were going to have a conversation with him. My husband and I, a loving conversation to help him get some purchase on his life, his adult life. It was set for Monday, or Sunday morning it was. And he called to say that he couldn't come on Sunday morning, but he could come Sunday at 5 p.m. My first thought, nope, not going to work because I'll be drinking then. So I was protecting my drinking, and I was putting that higher than my duty to be a responsible parent to our son. Another thing happened. Our friends, good friends in Richmond, we've been friends with them for almost 30 years. We vacationed together, we're closest of friends. They moved into a new house. They invited us over for a housewarming. "Yeah, we're going to come see your new house." So I had some get ready drinks at home, as I always did. Then we drove to their house, which wasn't far. And my friend Nancy really wanted to show us their new house. I didn't care a whit about that. All I was thinking about was, where is the drink? I was so interested and focused on getting the drink. And I became aware of that in the moment. Is this the kind of friend I want to be? Is this what alcohol is doing to me? supplanting my heart for the bottle, another thing happened. And these are things that happen like all in a row. Our older son had gotten a promotion. Yay! We wanted to celebrate with him. So he came over around 4:30 to celebrate. We were going to have dinner. And I said, hey, this calls for a martini. Shake it up, have martinis. And by the time I was the only one drinking the martinis. By the time we sat down to dinner at 7 o'clock, I was too drunk to sit at the table. And I made some remark like, well, I've overshot the target here. I don't think I'll be able to stay through dinner. And I stumbled back to our bedroom. I'm pretty sure I fell, but I don't remember. I just have this vague memory of it. And I don't remember getting into bed. My husband came back to check on me. I was completely passed out. I have no recollection of him coming back there. And the next day, I said to myself, is this the kind of parent I want to be? Is this the kind of wife I want to be? Drinking is more important to me than my relationships. Then, a couple of weeks later, I drank too much, stumbled back to pass out on the bed. Sometime in the night, I got up to go to the bathroom, went into our little bathroom that's attached to our room. The bathroom is a very small room. It's a square room, 8 by 8. And to give it a little more of a way of being roomier, we had taken out all the, like the shower stall, and there was a cabinet in there. We took all that out and just made this bare square with a toilet. And then the shower was just a cordoned off place with a shower curtain in the corner. So that was our shower. And when I was in the bathroom, I was coming into the bathroom and I fell and I grabbed for the first thing I could, and it was the shower curtain. And I pulled the whole shower curtain bar down from the ceiling. I have only the vaguest recollection of this. But the next morning, when my husband woke up, he went into the bathroom and saw this destruction. And he was so tender and gentle. He said, it's a good thing you weren't driving. It's a good thing you didn't fall and hit your head. He loves me. But I looked at the destruction and I said to myself, this 8 by 8 room is my life. This is a metaphor for my life. And I'm pulling my life down by the rafters in order to keep drinking. That was a fact that I was struggling not to see. And here's the final thing that happened. It breaks my heart even today to say it. One evening, I was drinking as usual. I was in my recliner. I had a tumbler of ice cold gin, and my husband came in. It was probably 8 o'clock at night, and he said, I'm going to go on to bed. And I said, okay. And he kissed me good night. And I saw him turn and walk away from me, moving to the corridor towards our bedroom. And my thought was, I'm happy. I am happy that you are walking away, because this means I can drink. I can drink all I want to, unobserved. And I realized this beautiful man with whom I have built my life and we have built a family, I'm choosing drink over him. That's what I'm doing. And that was December the 7th of 2020, December the 8th of 2020. I went to my first AA meeting. Well, the first real one, the one that would stick so far, thank God. So that is what got me into the rooms. What it's like now is that AA has become my life. I am earnestly working the steps, earnestly. And my childhood was very secular. We did not have any church experience. We never went to church. Holidays were had no religious component to them. But I had a long history of searching for God. Is there a God? Who is God? What does it even mean to be in relationship with God? And I was very much in my head about that. I studied it. I went to extreme to try to find the answers to those questions, those intellectual questions I had about religion and spirituality. But it turned out that the group, the AA group, became my higher power. And the reason for that is that instead of an intellectual believing, it was a spiritual feeling of connectedness, one to the other, one alcoholic to another, this alcoholic to me, me to this alcoholic. The fabric of that, the way it touched me was so deep and so profound. I felt that the group, that there was and is something tender and unnameable that is growing in my heart to trust that there is a higher power. And I, for me, I hope this doesn't offend anyone, but I'm still hesitant to use the word God because that clicks me into a real intellectual place. So I'm trying to hold on to the feeling of the program and the way that the steps teach me to lead my life, to treat others, to how to treat myself. How to see when I'm wrong and admit when I'm wrong. And I just want to tell you this one thing that happened recently. I actually shared my story with my home group in August, and here we are in October. My story's different today than it was because I've grown so much, even in this short time since then. The thing that happened in between then and now is that my sponsor told me I needed to make amends to my parents who have been dead now for 36 years. And I bristled at that. I pushed back on that. And I even said these words, "How could it have been my fault? I was a child. What do I have to apologize for?" Very self-pitying. Anyway, she said in her wisdom, "You have things you can apologize for. I want you to take some time, write your fourth step, tell your part in the trials of your relationship with your parents." And it took me some real pain to do that. But what I came up with was I've carried bitterness against them for years. I'm 65 years old. I've carried bitterness for my whole adult life. I have allowed myself to be defined by that bitterness. And so I did have something to apologize for. I saw it then. I'd never seen it before. So I drove down to Chapel Hill from Richmond. I had not visited my parents' grave site for 30 years. And I went to their grave. I knelt at their grave marker. And I asked for their forgiveness. And I told all of what I was sorry for. And that was one of the most profound moments of my whole life. It changed me. I do not feel bitterness now. I feel sorrow and grief, but not bitterness anymore, not resentment. So I, every day, I want to do the 12 steps. I want to live them. I want to treat others with love and kindness and outreach. And this AA is my, what, how might I say, my version of spirituality. As I grow toward a deeper understanding of God. Thank you for letting me share.
Yeah.